From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I've been adventuring deep into the forest with what feels like a fresh sensibility, a whole new set of eyes, I guess you could say, thanks to the collaborative effort by photographer Robert Llewellyn and environmental scientist Joan Maloof. Their new book is called The Living Forest, A Visual Journey into the Heart of the Woods. Co-author Joan Maloof is founder of the Old Growth Forest Network, aimed to preserve, protect, and promote the country's few remaining stands of old growth forest. And she's a professor emeritus at Salisbury University in Maryland, and she joins me today to talk about trees. So welcome back to the program, Joan. It's so nice to speak to you again.
Thank you, Margaret. Yes, well, it's nice to have this opportunity.
What a productive year you're having.
I know. It's crazy. The Nature's Temples came out just exactly a year ago, and then already The Living Forest.
Yes. So I should remind, I'll just do a little housekeeping thing. I should remind listeners right up top here that a full transcript of this episode of our conversation, including some of Robert's photos from the book and links for more information about you and about the book, and also the chance to enter a book giveaway for The Living Forest, will all be posted at awaytogarden.com. So if people want to learn more as they're listening. So how did this matchup between you and photographer Robert Llewellyn come to pass?
Well, I had already met Robert Llewellyn because we have a lot of tree people that support the Old Growth Forest Network in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Robert Llewellyn lives just outside of Charlottesville on this beautiful property surrounded by acres of forest. And he has done books such as The Remarkable Trees of Virginia and Seeing Trees and Seeing Flowers, just these amazing photographic works. And with the Old Growth Forest Network, at one point we wanted to use one of his images, the one of a tiny oak seedling sprouting from an acorn with the roots there. Mm. It just seemed like the perfect thing for our young little organization. You know, we wanted to grow strong and mighty as an oak, but we were just getting started. And I just gave him a call, and he got on the telephone and said, yes, we're welcome to use that for no cost. So that was very nice. And the next time I was in Charlottesville giving talks, I went to visit him personally, and we talked about forests and his photography, and I got to see his incredible studio, which is like a museum. And so we developed a relationship that way and a conversation about forests, and I read his books and he read my books. And then I was working on the book Nature's Temples, which I call it my science-y book that we've talked about before that has the evidence for the biodiversity in old growth forests. And I was awarded a writer's retreat to live in southern France for a month to work on that book, the draft of that book.
Oh.
And that was a great experience, as you might imagine. But one day I got a call from the States, and it was Robert Llewellyn, and he said that he was inviting me to be the writer on his next book, which was going to be an exploration of the eastern deciduous forest ecosystem. And of course, I was thrilled and immediately said, yes, I will do it.
Yes.
It's just as soon as this other one's done. And it was almost done. And so that's how I ended up with two books back to back so quickly.
Ah, well, we've spoken before, as we were just saying, when your previous book, Nature's Temples, came out. And the latest book, The Living Forest, is big. It's big in size. It's big in subject matter. But at the same time, it's sort of very intimate and full of these tiny little details, like, you know, there's delicious pictures of millipedes and salamanders and fungi and, you know, all kinds of things that most of us visiting forests might not have noticed or at least not understood, you know. So what was the mission of the book, and how's it different from the ones you've written previously?
Well, with the previous books, when we look at forests and how we've treated them in this country and in the world, there can be a lot of almost sorrow or regret,
yes,
or feel like we've made some mistakes, and the evidence shows that also. But this book, I wanted to be the opposite of that. I wanted this book to be the celebration for how the forest does work perfectly as this integrated ecosystem all on its own. And so in this book, I stayed away from all the gloom and doom and just focused on the rightness of it. And as you pointed out, the scale was very important in this book because it goes from the largest of the large, you know, these beautiful vista, forested vistas in the Smoky Mountains and the Shenandoah, all the way down to the tiniest little thing in the soil. And so it was quite a challenge in the beginning. Like, how do we tell that complete story of a forest that's connected in so many different dimensions and scales and even through time? And so that was part of the joy of crafting this holistic type story and drawing attention to all these connections. And Robert had the skills to be able to do that on every level, which,
yes,
was remarkable also, because often photographers will specialize in either the very large or the very small or in the middle somewhere, but he has the full range of talent and equipment to deal with it.
That's why I said I think it feels very big, because you're seeing from, like, the canopy, you're looking down into herons, rooks, is that what they're called, rooks or nests, you know, of herons.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and then the rookery of the blue herons.
Yeah, and then you're crawling around down below with the little creatures I was mentioning before, and you're at the roots, and you're all over the place. And
even at one point, because he had provided me, he'd been already photographing for 2 years by the time he invited me to write this. And so he gave me folders full of these amazing photographs. And this is the raw material that which I drew from to put all this together. But still, there were certain places where I thought, oh, I want to talk, you know, more about the larval salamander. I want to discuss the stomata, the pores and leaves. And so I also gave Robert this list of things that we needed in addition. He called them treasure hunts.
Yeah.
And he got people to help him, and they went on treasure hunts. But so, for example, I said, we need a close-up of a leaf, super close-up of a leaf. So he gave me a close-up of a leaf, and I said, we need it closer. And he gave me a closer one. I said, we need it even closer. Do you have a microscope? And he says, I do. And so for that one, we finally got so close that we could see the pores on the leaf, and
right,
we used a microscope to do that and ended up providing a beautiful image for that.
When you said you wanted stomata, you meant you wanted them. You,
yes,
weren't kidding around.
And we had so much fun then because, you know, Robert knew in theory that the leaves had pores that did all this work, but he had never seen it with his own eyes through the microscope. So there he was looking, and he got to see things in a new way, and he was just amazed at how there were, like, little mouths that control so much of our atmosphere.
So one of the chapters in the book is called A Deep Breath, and you're making me think of that chapter as you're speaking just now. So let's talk a little bit about that, about how is the forest taking a deep breath, or maybe it is a deep breath.
The organism is
a deep breath.
And on so many different scales, right? Also, because it could be the deep breath of that individual little stomata that's opened all the way, going, oh, conditions are just right. You know, I've got plenty of water and the sun is shining and, you know, I'm just going to go for it and open this pore all the way and exchange as many materials as I can, to the deep breath of the whole forest. And that would be this, things going in and out of those stomata all at once. So the inhale of the forest during the daylight hours would be the inhale of carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And those leaves are taking that in because the carbon dioxide is the basis of those sugars that it builds with photosynthesis and then stores in all of the wood that we see and all the flowers and all of the leaves that's actually making the forest. So that's the inhale of the carbon dioxide. And if we could measure, well, we can measure the carbon dioxide in the forest, and we could see that it drops down in the daytime when the forest is taking that inhale, and then it goes back up at night when the forest is, cells are continuing to work, but they're not doing photosynthesis. And the other part of that forest breathing has to do with the water vapor, because we know that those roots are taking in water and drawing it all the way up the stem in those vessels, all the way out to every leaf cell. But only 10% of that water is used in the photosynthetic process. 90% of it is just lost out of those pores.
Huh.
Well, we say lost, but I should say like emitted. And then that water vapor enters the atmosphere and is carried aloft where it cools off and then will be carried on the prevailing winds and turn into rain somewhere else for another forest.
Oh, yes.
So, it's beautiful. I mean, talk about large scale.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
now
yeah.
we're on the global scale
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
And how almost half of all our rainfall is dependent on this forest exhale of water.
You talk, this I've had, I think, of that chapter, a deep breath is lungs of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and indeed, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's,
yeah.
So that's what the forest is.
Yes.
So I live in surrounded by this 7,000-acre state park, sort of a forest adjacent to another one across the state line just beyond my house, and lots of other privately held large tracts of wooded land. So I'm not a stranger to the woods, but when I was looking at it with sort of you two, you and Robert as my guides, you know, paging through this book and reading this book, it really felt different, as if it was much, much more than the trees. And I mentioned some of the other creatures, but even just when I looked at the trees, they seemed, in the pictures, they just seemed different to me. How do you describe the forest? Like we just said, it's this lungs of the land. It's a deep breath. Mm. But what else? What are some of its other aspects?
Well, one thing that I like to emphasize is that a forest is more than just trees. We've been talking about the trees, and we tend to think of the trees, but the trees are really more like the bones, the structure.
Right.
Yes, you know, we need that structure of the forest, those big bones to give it the dimensional qualities, but there's so much more happening than just the trees. There are the insects that feed on the trees and the reptiles and amphibians that feed on the insects and the fungi that's growing underground and occasionally sending up a mushroom that then is eaten by a snail or by a turtle, and the lichens that are growing on the rocks that are shaded by the trees. So this book, we try to include all of those dimensions of the forest. And it's one thing to just say that the forest includes all those dimensions, but then when we are able to capture in a visual representation, like in the photograph, one of those parts of it, whether it's the lichens or the snails or the turtles
yeah.
or the mushrooms, then that itself becomes a sort of a place where we can recognize the beauty of the forest, which is another whole layer as far as what it does to us emotionally. So when I walk through the forest, and I would suggest this to others, yes, appreciate the trees and the individual trees, but try to feel the whole and also try to leave yourself open for those moments of surprise where there's whether it's even the pattern of a root across a rock or the most perfect fall color pattern you've ever seen on a leaf or whatever it is, but mm-hmm. just to also leave your spirit and energy open for appreciation.
So speaking of little surprises that I found along the way, I learned so many things that I've wondered about and I've asked people about, and I couldn't get a clear answer, and I got the clear answer. So that was it was a happy surprise. For instance, that you just mentioned fungi, and where I live, there's a lot of evidence in the older trees, especially of the shelf fungi. Mm-hmm. And then I had also a million years ago heard the word conch. And mm-hmm. I didn't know what was the difference, a conch, mm-hmm. a shelf. And sure enough, you explain the ones that are sort of shaped like hooves, like an animal's hoof, mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. that are sort of downward curved-ish, they're,
right.
Yeah, those are the conchs. And so
right.
it was little things like that. It was, again, that was like that intimacy, like you were teaching me not just the look, mm-hmm. but you were giving me the language. And or another thing, I'm crazy about moths. And a lot of people don't go into the forest at night. It might be, it seems scary or whatever, but moths are one thing that you'll see if you go out at night.
mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how they escaped from being eaten by bats. And you reveal, because I can't hear bats except for maybe some clicking occasionally in certain species I think you can hear. But bats with their sort of echolocation, their sonar, whatever it is, I guess the moths can hear that, and so
yeah, some moths can hear that, yeah, and they can avoid
yeah.
the bats, and some can even jam the radar of the bats
right.
and trick them and make their own little sounds that we can't hear.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like everybody's trying to get a meal. Everyone's trying mm-hmm. to survive till tomorrow. Everybody's mm-hmm. feeding and also offering themselves as food in some way, and it's just this community of interdependence. And I think that's really what I got a lot of detail in the book. And I want to ask you about another chapter, the chapter called Eyes All Over.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes, E-Y-E-S, if people are listening, not
yeah.
reading.
Yeah.
So can we talk about your assertion that trees can see?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so, Joan, tell us about this now.
Well, we'll start with our eyes. We have these parts of our bodies that are sensitive to light. And how do we see light? Well, we have these cells in the back of our retinas that contain pigments. And when this light hits these pigments, then it causes a reaction, a change in another molecule that can send a message, in our case, through our neurons to our brain, saying, oh, you saw something, or you saw light. And also, the light that we see can also affect our hormones. As we know, if people suffer from seasonal oppressive disorder, SAD,
yes.
some people this time of year are just starting to feel that perhaps coming on. I mean, that is a reaction to what is coming in through our retinas or not coming in. So when you look at talk about trees this time, a tree leaf, each of those cells in the leaf contains, in this green leaf, these pigments that are light detecting, because light is so important to the plants. That's how they make their food.
Right.
And these pigments, just like the pigments in our eyes, change structure depending on what type of light is hitting them. And that causes a reaction also in the plants, the same way we have a reaction. But instead of them, going through their neurons and to their brain saying you've just seen something, instead it goes directly to the hormonal system of the plant, and the plant will produce certain chemicals, hormone chemicals, depending on how much light they saw, like how many hours in a day, or whether it was green light or blue light, because these photosynthetic cells can tell the difference in the wavelength, the quality of light.
Oh.
So a leaf knows if it's being shaded by another tree or by a building, depending on the wavelength that comes through. And it also knows if it's midday or early morning or late afternoon, depending on the quality of the wavelength. And so I don't want to get too geeky about this, but extrapolating then in my mind, so my mind says, okay, if these plants can sense these wavelengths and they'll do certain things depending on the wavelengths, like make berries or change colors or drop their leaves, that means if I wear a red jacket into the forest, that's reflecting a different wavelength than if I wore a black jacket into the forest. So in a way, although I haven't read the scientific data on this specifically, I think the photosynthetic leaves can also sense the colors that we present to them.
Huh.
So that's how the forest is seeing us, too.
Oh, boy. So it knows, the plant knows the season of the year and the time of day and the intensity and so forth. And they say, like, where the light fits into the spectrum, all the different qualities of light.
Yes.
In the same way that we do. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, but we can, you know, close the window shades or open the door or flip on the light switch. But the trees can't do any of that. So, but they do respond, but they respond so ever so slowly and only and by the process of growth. You know, so it could be the response could be chemical that will cause a change in growth. It'll cause the berries to form, the berries to ripen, the buds to form, or it will cause the branch to grow in this direction and not the other direction. So it's such, it's a response, but it's a very slow and graceful response.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I guess I want to ask you something about fall, because here we are, and the leaves have been going and going and going. I'm in the north. You're in the...
Going.
Yeah. but sometimes they don't fall all the way. All of them don't fall. And I, one of my favorite words is the word marcescent. I think that's how you say it. So for, like, people might see in an oak tree where the leaves are withered, they're brown, but they stay up there. So just in the last 2 minutes or so that we have, just tell me something about leaves falling or not.
So the usual pattern in a deciduous tree, those are trees that drop the leaves, are that the color changes, the green pigments get recycled, the red is actually like a sunscreen pigment that's made to protect the leaf, but eventually, and again, this is a response to the trees seeing the light and knowing the fall's coming, they will produce a layer like of scar tissue at the very base of the leaf. And that will eventually cause the leaf to break off at that, at, right at that point, at the base of the petiole. But some trees, as you know, like the oaks and also the beech, they don't drop their leaves in the fall. They'll hold on to their brown leaves and usually drop them in the spring. And we don't really understand why there's that difference, but we know that there is. And some people have speculated that with the beech trees, that the dry, dead leaves may make them less tasty to the deer that might want to browse them.
I've read that. Yes, I've read that.
And so I thought that was very interesting. And again, we can just appreciate it with our hearts and spirits, too, and see how beautiful they are. But if you have a tree like a maple that normally would drop its leaves in the fall and that doesn't happen, that's a signal that something has gone wrong in that system, because that tree normally should have made that abscission zone that caused the leaf to drop off. So and, there's sometimes it's the right, the plant normally does, and sometimes it's unusual.
Yeah, so leaves fall and sometimes they don't. And I love this new book, and it's a feast, it really is. Joan Maloof, co-creator of the new book, The Living Forest. I'm so appreciative of your time, Joan. Thank you for being with us again.
Thank you, Margaret. It's been a pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye.
and talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. Happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.